Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading news stories from Reuters for Thursday, July 2, 2026. Young survivors of Venezuela quakes run shelters as search drags on. By Julia Sims Cobb and Vivian Sequeira. La Guaira, Venezuela. The command center hums with activity as radios crackle to life, medical staff stop in to say hello, and supplies are arranged in orderly piles. Though this organization would not be out of place at a military barracks overseen by generals, the deployment is taking place at the Republic of Panama School in La Guaira, the Venezuelan state hardest hit by twin earthquakes last week, and the commanders, casually dressed volunteers, are aged between 20 and 27. Their task is the management of a shelter for victims of the magnitude 7.2 and 7.5 quakes, which devastated this part of the South American country after striking less than a minute apart, killing more than 2,200, according to the latest tally. The dozen or so staff, members of the youth wing of Venezuela's Socialist Party, have designed a digital system to register residents, most of whom have lost loved ones, their homes, or both in the disaster. The volunteer team is also largely homeless after the quakes and rotate work shifts to staff the command center 24 hours a day. Like other shelter residents, they sleep in a classroom stuffed with metal bunk beds delivered by the Commerce Ministry. The group's system has information about each of the more than 350 people staying at the shelter, where an average of three families sleep per classroom. The program records their previous addresses, injuries, and who has yet to grab lunch in the cafeteria. "We're like the Titanic. We go down with the ship," said Daniel Rivas, 25, as his colleagues searched the registry for a missing person sought by a relative standing at the school gate. Showers, a medical clinic, a laundromat, and cafeteria are available to the residents, whose children play in stairwells and on the basketball court. Each of the nine shelters in La Guaira is run by a different team, the staff at this school said. "People are 50% very sensitive and 50% full of rage, lost," said Jose Mendez, who is also part of the team. "They are angry about not finding their family members, about losing everything, but we're ready to help." All the team members were born just before or in the years after La Guaira's last major disaster, a 1999 landslide that killed up to 30,000 people. Last week's quakes have killed 2,295, according to government figures published on Wednesday. An unofficial but widely used list of the missing stands at 40,567. A United Nations envoy this week said it was procuring 10,000 body bags for Venezuela, and the USGS has estimated more than 10,000 deaths were possible due to the quakes. The school has functioning bathrooms and places for play, but other shelters lack privacy, safe spaces for children, and hygiene facilities, said Geraldine Gomez of NGO Plan International. "There are no separate spaces for mothers. There are no separate spaces for children. Children have no space for recreation, for play, for talking," she said. Residents have criticized the government of interim president Delcy Rodriguez for what they call a slow and inadequate response by the state, while NGO International Rescue Committee on Tuesday said the scale of the response was not meeting humanitarian needs. Rodriguez, in a post on X, said that authorities continue helping those affected, as well as supervising recovery efforts. "I know that many Venezuelans feel pain and frustration. I deeply share those feelings," she said, before declaring 7 days of national mourning. The volunteer team at the school is waiting on two major next steps: visits from the registration authority to replace lost government identification cards, and from the housing ministry to clarify what people who lost their homes should do to get aid. "I feel like I still have the earthquake within me," said shelter resident Daisy Tapias, 36, who is staying at the shelter with two of her five children. I wish I could go home. Her apartment, further down the coast, was nearly destroyed, though her 17-year-old son was able to rescue their identity cards and tank of cooking gas from the ruins. Tapias said she was willing to move out of state if that is how she can replace her home. Her mother, Daisy Bermudez, 55, has an intact home in a nearby community and arrived with clothing and food for her family. I can't stand shelters, said Bermudez, who lost her house in the 1999 disaster, and said she missed out on government housing constructed afterward for victims. As the women spoke with Reuters, an army transport truck pulled up outside, and soldiers helped eight new families carrying in sparse bags of belongings, where they were welcomed by the team. Many of those arriving now have been living alongside the ruins, the team said, and searching for loved ones trapped under rubble. Dozens of police officers lined the road deeper into La Guaira, some directing traffic, while others gestured waves of cars, trucks, and motorcycles onward. Soldiers carrying automatic weapons stood guard at several intersections. Deep into the rubble at the Hugo Chavez housing complex, known colloquially as Los Cocos, alongside what used to be a basketball court, a ragtag civilian rescue team, assisted by a handful of Army soldiers, removed three bodies they began uncovering yesterday. The volunteers first pulled the remains onto bedsheets gathered from the rubble and then hoisted the bodies into black plastic body bags. One bag ripped at the top. The two women and one man died holding on to each other. Just below them, civilian rescuers digging a different tunnel say they can hear a scratching sound, though not knocking or any voices. They do not know whether they are hearing a human or an animal. 27-year-old Yiscar Zagire sat outside the tunnel, watching as her husband John Berroteran, 26, worked to remove debris from inside it. He hopes to recover Zagire's father, Oscar Zagire, 43, stepmother Elizabeth Vargas, 44, and 8-year-old half-sister Cristal. Clad for safety in a black motorcycle helmet, Berroteran ordered silence on at least three occasions so he could listen for a response beneath the rubble. Zagire, who has been in Los Cocos since Saturday, said she was not sure whether those being sought could actually turn out to be her family. But it doesn't matter, she said. We have to get them all out. Russia bombards Kyiv in major strike, at least 18 people killed. By Gleb Galinich and Olena Harmash. Kyiv. Russia launched hundreds of drones and dozens of missiles at Ukraine's capital Kyiv in the early hours on Thursday, tearing apart several residential buildings, killing at least 18 people, and wounding scores. Multiple explosions shook central Kyiv and reverberated across the capital throughout the night as thousands of residents rushed to bomb shelters and underground metro stations. The attack caused the widest destruction in Kyiv so far this year and was the deadliest since at least May, when 24 people were killed in a strike that brought down an apartment block. President Volodymyr Zelensky, who cut short a visit to Ireland to rush home, said damage had been reported at more than 20 sites across the capital. The main strike was directed at Kyiv, he said. Air defense supplies for Ukraine are an absolute and critical priority, he said, urging Ukraine's allies to maintain contributions to a fund to buy U.S. weapons, including Patriot air defense missiles for Ukraine. Russia launched 74 missiles and 496 drones overnight, the Ukrainian Air Force said. Yuri Inat, the Air Force spokesperson, said the number of ballistic missiles was unusually high and the interception rate for them was low. Ukraine has struggled with shortages of Patriot missiles in recent months. The Russian Defense Ministry, in a Telegram post, said its massive attack, using long-range, high-precision air, land, sea-launched weapons and drones, hit military and energy facilities, as well as airports in Kyiv and other locations. Moscow said the attacks were retaliation for the Ukrainian drone strikes on Russia. Kyiv, which has stepped up strikes in recent weeks on Russia's domestic fuel supply, said it had hit an oil refinery overnight in the Russian region of Nizhny Novgorod, where the governor reported one person killed in a strike on an industrial facility. The Kremlin said Russian military commanders briefed President Vladimir Putin about the Russian attacks, adding that Moscow would continue to increase pressure on Ukraine to achieve its war aims. Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko announced a day of mourning in Kyiv for Friday. He said that damage was recorded across the entire city of about 3 million people, with some buildings heavily damaged. Katerina Matronova, the EU ambassador to Ukraine, said that Russia unleashed hell on Kyiv overnight and had struck accommodation used by diplomatic personnel. Diplomats were unharmed, but their belongings were damaged in the fire that engulfed the building, she said. Emergency services were sifting through the rubble of what used to be a 9-story building on the left bank of the Dnipro River that bisects the city as the sun rose and fires flared up around it. City officials said that more than 90 people, including children, paramedics, and drivers at an ambulance station, were wounded, and that some people were still trapped inside damaged residential buildings. "Our house is on fire. Oleg was pulling our neighbor out of the burning house while I was phoning all the emergency services during the explosions," Irina Plekova, a Kyiv resident, said on Facebook, posting a picture of a half-destroyed apartment building with no windows. "We do not have an apartment anymore." The National Institute of Biochemistry was among many buildings damaged. Its state-of-the-art biochemistry laboratory and other offices were gutted during the attack. "This is a catastrophe for medical and biological science of Ukraine," biologist Yuri Danilovich told Reuters, saying the lab housed rare equipment. Ukraine's neighbor Poland, a NATO and EU member, briefly scrambled fighter jets as a preventive measure. Finland also briefly issued a temporary aviation restriction zone in the eastern Gulf of Finland, its defense forces said. After years in which Ukraine bore the brunt of relentless long-range attacks from Russia, Kyiv has intensified its own strikes deeper into Russian territory in recent months, mainly hitting energy targets. That has triggered a fuel crisis in Russia, forcing the world's third biggest oil producer to import gasoline from as far away as India. Russia has responded with a stepped-up air campaign against Ukrainian cities, last month hitting a 1,000-year-old Kyiv cathedral, foundational to the Orthodox faith in both countries. Kaya Kallas, the EU's foreign policy chief, said only sustained military support for Ukraine and increased pressure on Moscow could help stop Russian attacks. "Today, I will propose to sanction more entities supporting Russia's military-industrial complex in response to the strikes," she said in a post on X. "The more Moscow attacks civilians, the more sanctions must be imposed." Zelensky has proposed talks with Putin to end the more than 4-year-old war, which the Kremlin leader has rejected. Russia has killed thousands of Ukrainian civilians in strikes on Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities since it launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Moscow denies intentionally attacking civilians, but says attacks on what it describes as civil infrastructure are legitimate because they hurt Ukraine's ability to wage war. Kyiv has also launched attacks on Russia and Russian-occupied Ukraine on a far smaller scale. U.S.-Iran talks conclude in Doha, focused on Strait of Hormuz. By Andrew Mills, Parisa Hafezi, and Jacob Bogage. Doha, Dubai, Virginia Beach, Virginia. Iran and the United States concluded a round of indirect talks on Wednesday with no sign they had made headway toward a lasting peace, focusing instead on issues that they said had been resolved when an interim agreement was announced 2 weeks ago. Sources familiar with the discussions said negotiators for the two countries spent 2 days in Doha discussing maritime traffic in the Strait of Hormuz and unfreezing Iran's funds, two critical issues under the initial agreement. The next meeting will take place after funeral processions for Iran's late Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who is due to be buried on July 9, Qatar's foreign ministry said. The Doha discussions produced positive progress on issues related to the memorandum that halted the war in June and were building on the outcomes of a summit in Switzerland, the ministry spokesperson said in a post on X. In Washington, U.S. President Donald Trump said the two sides were making progress on possible limits to Iran's nuclear program, the main reason he launched the war along with Israel in February. "The denuclearization of Iran is moving along well," he told reporters. "They've had very good meetings, and we'll see." But the sources said the nuclear program did not come up in the talks, which were technical in nature. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance said that matter would be addressed later. "Obviously, we're worried about the nuclear issue. We're going to start talking about that," he told reporters. American and Iranian negotiators held separate meetings with Qatari and Pakistani mediators, Qatar's foreign ministry said. Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner and top U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff, dispatched to the region for what the White House had billed as high-level talks, did not attend the sessions, according to a source who spoke on condition of anonymity. The leader of Iran's delegation, Deputy Foreign Minister Kazem Gharibabadi, said the talks concluded. Neither side said whether they had managed to bridge any of their differences. The initial deal calls for Iran and the United States to allow shipping to resume through the Strait of Hormuz, which handled one-fifth of global oil and liquid natural gas trade before the war. Though traffic has partially resumed, the status of the strategic waterway remains unclear, and the two countries exchanged strikes last weekend following an Iranian attack on a cargo ship. Iran is determined to win international recognition of its control over the strait, even if it has to do so by force, two senior Iranian sources said, and has repeatedly said it will assess tolls on shipping, starting in mid-August, after a toll-free period specified by the initial agreement expires. Trump's comments on Wednesday played down the possibility of a return to all-out war with Iran. "I think they've come a long way," he said. Oil prices fell to their lowest level in 4 months following Trump's remarks, and analysts cut their price forecasts for the first time since the war began. Iran's state media said on Wednesday that a foreign container ship had run aground in shallow waters outside the shipping route designated by Iranian authorities. "Hormuz continues to reopen, but it's patchy, unpredictable, and not fully transparent," said Vandana Hari, founder of oil market analysis provider Vanda Insights. Several European countries have offered to help clear mines from the strait, but Germany's defense minister Boris Pistorius said he did not expect his country to participate, citing Iran's unwillingness to cooperate with other countries. Members of rebel Catholic group in schism excommunicated, Vatican says. By Joshua McElwee. Vatican City. The Vatican said on Thursday that priests and lay Catholics who are part of a breakaway right-wing Catholic group that ordained bishops without Pope Leo's approval were in schism with the wider church and now excommunicated. In a strong decree, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, the top watchdog authority for the 1.4 billion member church, also warned Catholics globally that the Swiss-based Society of St. Pius X now celebrated the sacraments illicitly. The ultra-traditionalist group, which denies key church teachings, cannot officiate marriages or hear confessions validly, the decree said. It is a strict teaching of the Church that only the Pope can authorize the consecration of new bishops in order to maintain the Church's ties to Jesus' 12 apostles, who are considered the first priests and bishops. The Society was not available for immediate comment on the Vatican decree. One member of the group, who said he was not authorized to speak but identified himself as Father Benedict, told Reuters after a mass in Econ, Switzerland, he expected the group would just continue on as before. "We will just keep going," he said. "We do respect the Pope. We will keep praying for him." He also criticized the Vatican's response. "This sanction shows that, I mean, we did not close the door to the Holy Father, to the Holy See," Benedict added. "They shut it in our face. So that's the sad reality. The Church considers unauthorized ordination of bishops as so serious that it causes those taking part in the ceremony to be automatically excommunicated or out of communion with the wider Church and unable to receive sacraments until they repent and ask for forgiveness. Thursday's decree said the two bishops leading the unauthorized ordination, held in Switzerland on Wednesday, had been excommunicated, along with the four priests who had become new bishops, which was widely expected. However, the Vatican went further than expected and said that all priests of the Society of St. Pius X and all Catholics who adhere formally to the group were now in schism and excommunicated. A schism is a term to indicate a severe formal rupture within the Catholic community. The Society of St. Pius X denies the central teachings of the Second Vatican Council, a landmark Vatican gathering of bishops in the 1960s that pursued a range of reforms for the global church and sought to repair its relations with Jews and other Christian denominations. The council also allowed for the Mass, until then said only in Latin, to be celebrated in local languages. The Society rejected that change, citing a desire for the Latin rite's sense of mystery and formality. Massimo Fagioli, an expert on the papacy, told Reuters that Leo believed very firmly in the reforms of the council, often referred to by Catholics as Vatican II. "He has no regrets, no doubts about the fact that this is the Church of Vatican II," said Fagioli, a professor at Villanova University outside Philadelphia. "He has shown that he doesn't want to compromise on that." Leo told journalists in June that the divisions within the Society of St. Pius X were painful, but called the reforms of Vatican II fundamental elements of church teaching. "We must move forward," the Pope said. The Society, whose followers are sometimes known as Lefebvrists after their father, Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, says it counts 733 priests worldwide. Its leadership, which has long had tense relations with the Vatican, says it needed to ordain new bishops to have enough prelates to lead the group. Lefebvre was excommunicated in 1988 after ordaining four bishops without permission from then-Pope John Paul II. Benedict XVI, John Paul's successor, sought to renew dialogue with the Society and lifted four remaining excommunications. Firefighters battle blazes in southern France after European heatwave, by Manon Cruz. Lancôme, France. Firefighters were battling several wildfires fanned by strong winds in southern France on Thursday as the country grappled with parched conditions following Europe's recent heatwave. Interior Minister Laurent Nunez said three blazes, two of which broke out on the western edge of the Mediterranean port city of Marseille, had scorched a combined area of 2,990 acres. As Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu arrived on Thursday afternoon in Marseille to hold a new crisis meeting on the heat wave and the wildfires, a new blaze had just started near the city of Roquemaure in the Gard area, firefighters told Lecornu. The World Meteorological Organization last week warned that record temperatures that baked Western Europe for over a week in late June would worsen the risk of wildfires, given the outlook for sustained high temperatures, very low humidity, and dry vegetation. The biggest wildfire was burning in the Aude Administrative Department near the border with Spain, with some 900 hectares burnt. Local authorities said high winds were making it more difficult for the 800 firefighters to battle the fire. Meanwhile, firefighters were tamping down a small blaze in Rognac near Marseille's airport and had brought another fire covering 260 hectares in Lancôme, Provence under control. There were no casualties, local officials said. An acrid smell of smoke hung over the area, and pilots on at least one flight landing at the city assured passengers the smell was not coming from their aircraft, a Reuters witness said. Further east in Fréjus, a resort town in the Var department, some 22 miles from Cannes, more than 2,000 people were evacuated from six campsites on Wednesday because of a nearby forest fire. France's weather office has warned that another spell of extreme heat could hit next week. Health authorities estimate the previous heat wave may have caused at least 1,000 excess deaths in the country during record-breaking temperatures. Spain's amnesty drive brings 600,000 migrants into formal economy during application review. By Reuters. Madrid. Some 609,737 of the 1.17 million migrants in Spain who applied for legal status in its recent amnesty drive have obtained temporary work permits, government officials said on Thursday, enabling them to start work in the formal economy while their applications are under review. The drive, which grants a one-year renewable residence permit to undocumented migrants who have lived in Spain for at least 5 months before the end of 2025 and have no criminal record, was open for applications from April 16 to June 30. Further details provided on Thursday by Secretary of State for Migration Pilar Cancela and Secretary of State for Social Security Borja Suarez included: the total number of applications was more than double the government's initial estimate of 500,000, with most stemming from Latin American countries. Applicants are granted a temporary work permit while their applications are being processed. Of the 609,737 people granted temporary work permits so far, about 160,000 had secured formal employment by June 30, the officials said. 11,000 people have so far been granted their one-year residence permit. The government is partnering with businesses in construction, tourism, transport, and care sectors to help match migrants with jobs. And around 81% of undocumented migrants who applied for legal status are under the age of 45, and 57% of applicants are men. Greek ruling party calls for protests after firebomb kills candidate's mother. By Renee Maltizou. Athens. Greece's governing New Democracy Party called on Thursday for its supporters to take to the streets in protest after the 72-year-old mother of one of its parliamentary candidates died of severe burns from a firebomb attack. Attackers placed flaming gas canisters at three homes of local figures from the governing party in the northern city of Thessaloniki before dawn on Tuesday, causing explosions. Vahia Nestora, mother of New Democracy candidate Aphrodite Nestora, died of organ failure after suffering burns that covered 80% of her body, a hospital statement said. The candidate also suffered burns and three other people were wounded. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attacks, the first time in more than a decade that a person was killed in an attack targeting Greek politicians. Greece has a decades-long history of political violence, including bombings and arson attacks, but assassinations became rare 20 years ago after leaders of left-wing militant groups were jailed. Yesterday, we witnessed an extreme, coordinated, murderous attack against three New Democracy officials in Thessaloniki, government spokesperson Pavlos Marinakis said. This terrorist act was a cowardly act by extreme opponents of violence who operate under the guise of a so-called ideology against three people simply because they do not agree with their ideology. He added, the message we are sending is clear. Terrorism will not win. Nobody will be afraid. The New Democracy Party and its youth branch, ONED, called for a rally to honor the victim and protest against such attacks on Thursday evening outside the hospital where the woman died. We are not afraid of you, it said in a statement, saying its members stand united against terrorism. A police anti-terrorism unit has taken charge of the investigation into the incidents. Police spokeswoman Konstantina Demoglidou told Greek media that evidence showed the attacks were probably coordinated, and police were examining video footage to confirm that the same group of perpetrators launched all three attacks. EU determined to resolve standoff over Bosnia envoy, Kallas says, by Reuters. Sarajevo. The EU is determined to find a strong candidate for the post of international peace envoy for Bosnia and Herzegovina, EU Foreign Chief Kaja Kallas said on Thursday, to replace a German diplomat who resigned in May under what he described as U.S. pressure. Last month, countries failed to reach a consensus on a successor for Christian Schmidt as High Representative for Bosnia and Herzegovina, a post with wide powers in the country since the 1990s under international agreements that ended war there. The role has always been held by a European with a U.S. deputy. We are determined to find the European candidate who can help move Bosnia and Herzegovina forward, Kallas said during a visit to Bosnia. While the negotiations on a successor continue, ultimately the success of the Office of the High Representative will be measured by the day it is no longer needed, Kallas said. Until then, it remains an important pillar of stability. The U.S., which had announced that the U.S.-led nation-building era has passed, has made it clear that it wants a new envoy with a more limited mandate. It supported Italian diplomat Antonio Sanardi Landi for the job, while most European countries supported French diplomat René Trocas. The United States has said it would reconsider its role in Bosnia and Herzegovina unless its preferred candidate is approved. Earlier this week, Schmidt's deputy Louis Krychak was named as the acting high representative until a new envoy is appointed by July 14 at the latest. Bosnia is at the bottom of a queue of the Western Balkan hopefuls aspiring to join the EU, as it has stalled its reform progress due to political blockades over the past few years. Sustained reforms are the fastest and most effective way to advance the accession process, Kallas said, adding, this window of opportunity for accession may not be open forever. She said Bosnia had already lost 108 million euros in EU funding from the bloc's 6 billion euro growth plan for the region, and was facing the risk of losing an additional 370 million euro unless it proceeds with necessary reforms. Bosnia is divided into two political entities, one controlled by ethnic Serbs and one controlled by Bosniaks and Croats, with a weak central government supervised by the international envoy. The Bosnian Serb representatives in state institutions have been consistently blocking EU-related reforms, with their nationalist pro-Russian leadership dismissing EU accession and turning to the U.S. administration for support. UK's Starmer apologizes over forced adoptions, decries a stain on our history, by Muvija M. London. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer apologized on Thursday to women forced to give up their babies or separated from their mothers at birth under a system of forced adoptions that targeted unmarried women for decades after World War II. An estimated 185,000 children were separated from their mothers in Britain. Starmer apologized on behalf of the state for the lifelong trauma it had caused. On behalf of the whole country, I say it to every single person impacted. We are deeply and profoundly sorry, Starmer told Parliament, describing what happened to the victims as a stain on our history. The state did not do enough to protect mothers, children, and families from harm, and for this systematic failure, I am truly sorry. Between 1949 and 1976, the British state and Christian churches created a system in which young women with children outside marriage were shamed and coerced into giving up their babies to comply with the social norms of the time. The Church of England apologized for its role last month, acknowledging its involvement in running so-called mother and baby homes, where unmarried women were sent, often against their will, during pregnancy or after giving birth, and separated from their babies. The state's apology follows similar apologies by Ireland and Australia, 4 years after Britain's Human Rights Committee concluded that the government was ultimately responsible for the lack of protection for unmarried mothers and their babies. Starmer said the government would spend €4 million, $5.3 million, to help people access their adoption records, fund intermediary services that help people reconnect with family members, and for research and testimonial projects to document the long-term impact. Starmer had met a group of affected mothers and children at his Downing Street residence earlier on Thursday. "There was never any shame on you. The shame is actually ours," he said. "The shame is on the state and all those who were responsible for this." Malaria fears grow in Congo's Ebola outbreak hotspots. By Jennifer Rigby and Emma Farge. London, Nairobi. Malaria and other diseases may be as deadly as the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo, health officials have warned, as the outbreak strains the healthcare system and spooks patients into staying away from clinics. Half a dozen medics and local and international health officials told Reuters they are taking steps to limit deaths, but face long-standing healthcare gaps and delivery issues in a region plagued by conflict as well as patient fear. As has been the case in nearly every Ebola epidemic, it is likely that more people will die of malaria during this outbreak than of Ebola, said Bill Steiger, chief executive of the nonprofit Malaria No More. Malaria is a particular threat because it is widespread in Congo, including to varying degrees in the eastern provinces where the Ebola Bundibugyo outbreak is hitting hardest. There were around 35 million cases and 68,000 deaths in Congo in 2024, the second highest in the world after Nigeria, according to the World Health Organization. There are also long-standing gaps. Two planned distribution campaigns for insecticide-treated bed nets had to be canceled last year for security reasons in the provinces of Ituri and North Kivu, both areas at the center of the Ebola epidemic, an official from the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria told Reuters. That means many people are likely unprotected this year, as older nets have worn out, said Susie Nasser, the Global Fund's head of malaria. Congo's National Malaria Program did not respond to requests for comment. Nasser said there were already early signs of a rise in malaria cases in the Ebola outbreak areas, although that may be because of medics treating all suspected cases as confirmed while they avoid testing to limit their exposure to bodily fluids, highly infectious if the patient ultimately has Ebola. The diseases share similar symptoms, like fever, during their early stages. However, Nasser and others said work was underway to prevent a worst-case scenario. Buffer stocks of anti-malarial drugs were being transferred to the outbreak areas by the Congolese government, the Global Fund, and the Gates Foundation, she said. Teams are also considering mass drug administration of anti-malarials, going door-to-door in affected areas to hand out drugs to rapidly reduce the malaria burden. Still, medics working on the ground said they were worried about missing cases in the community. Dr. Aime Mbonda, Emergency Health Coordinator for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies in Bunia, Congo, estimated that roughly half of those experiencing symptoms may be unlikely to seek care, having watched community members with fever attend healthcare facilities and never return. Because people are waiting, we are now receiving more complicated cases and deaths. This is a big challenge, he said, adding that his team had met people who were frightened to admit to having symptoms. Nasser said the Global Fund and others were still working out how much money would be needed to prevent a malaria surge. There's already a massive shortfall for the Ebola response. Between the $1.4 billion Africa CDC says is needed and the $120 million currently delivered. Does the global health community realize malaria is probably a bigger risk than Ebola over the longer term? Yes, said Steiger. Are they responding? They are. Is it enough or quick enough? Maybe not. EU concerned by China's new ethnic unity law, which targets people overseas. By Reuters. Brussels. The European Union expressed concern on Thursday about China's new law on ethnic unity, which went into effect this week and gives Beijing the legal basis to take action against people outside its borders. China passed the law in March to create a shared national identity among the country's 55 ethnic minority groups, which include Tibetans and Uyghurs, some of whom chafe under Chinese rule and have over the years often staged protests, some of them violent. The new law, which went into effect on Wednesday, includes a clause saying people and groups beyond the borders of the People's Republic of China can be held legally accountable for undermining ethnic unity and progress or inciting ethnic separatism. In a statement, an EU spokesperson said the new law may further restrict the cultural, linguistic, and religious rights of ethnic minorities. Such rights should be upheld in line with international human rights standards and China's commitments within the UN framework, the spokesperson added. We are concerned about the extraterritorial application of the law. The EU opposes the extraterritorial application of third country legislation in breach of international law, the spokesperson said. We call on any third country to refrain from attempts to conduct transnational repression within the European Union or elsewhere. China's foreign ministry did not immediately respond to a request for comment. A senior Chinese official said last week that the government has a right to hold accountable people outside of its borders who contravene the law, adding that this was in line with international practice and was legal and necessary. Rights groups have previously complained that China has tried to use Interpol red notices to try and get foreign governments to arrest people abroad it wants for political offenses at home. The law has also sparked alarm in Chinese-claimed Taiwan, in particular, that it could give Beijing another legal basis to go after Taiwanese it views as separatists. In a separate statement on Thursday, Taiwan's China Policy-Making Mainland Affairs Council said the government will work with like-minded countries to resist the Chinese communists' threats. This is intimidation and coercion through malicious transnational repression, it added. China's legal system has no jurisdiction or authority in Taiwan, whose government rejects China's sovereignty claims. U.S. Supreme Court supercharges its shadow docket, dividing the justices. By Andrew Chung. Washington. When the U.S. Supreme Court issued its ruling defending the Federal Reserve from political interference, it not only prevented President Donald Trump from firing one of the central bank's governors, it also highlighted growing unease among the justices about the use of their ever-expanding emergency docket. Three of the four conservative justices who dissented in Monday's ruling involving the Fed's Lisa Cook also criticized the five justices who were in the majority for making such a consequential decision using the court's procedure designed for emergencies and short-circuiting lower courts in the process. That prompted Chief Justice John Roberts to defend the landmark action using this pathway in the Cook case as a matter of prudence on which people can disagree. Roberts authored the 5-4 ruling, joined by fellow conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh and the court's three liberal justices. Critics for years have raised concerns about the court's increasing willingness to decide major issues using the emergency docket, also called the shadow docket or interim docket, saying it lacks transparency and accountability to the public and gives short shrift to complex and high-stakes legal disputes. This docket lets the justices render decisions before lower courts have decided the legal merits of a case, generally bypassing the Supreme Court's regular procedures that involve extensive briefing, oral arguments, months of deliberation, and lengthy written rulings. Emergency orders typically are made rapidly and often provide no explanation or rationale. Now, another concern is emerging. As more and more emergency decisions usher in vast changes to the law and even alter the court's own precedents, the justices appear divided over just how powerful this process is becoming and how to wield it appropriately. The justices completed their latest 9-month term on Tuesday and entered a summer recess. Their next term begins in October. What I find really telling is that Roberts felt he had to respond to it. He didn't have to. The opinion could have just decided the case, said Bradley University law professor Tara Lee Davis, an expert on the emergency docket, referring to the complaint by the dissenting justices. He felt the pressure of the complaint enough to put a principle on paper for the first time, Davis added, and the principle he lands on, that it's a matter of prudence, is honestly pretty honest about the fact that there is no rule, there is no formula. Formerly used only rarely, the court in recent years has transformed the emergency docket into a powerful force in American life, employing it to a specially dramatic effect since Trump returned to office in January 2025. The court, with its 6-3 conservative majority, backed Trump in numerous emergency decisions that let him implement contentious policies impeded by lower courts, while legal challenges continued to play out. Its emergency decisions have let Trump fire federal employees, take control of independent agencies, ban transgender people from the military, proceed with aggressive immigration raids, and deport migrants to countries where they have no ties, among other actions. The conservative justices have wielded this power in multiple ways, largely siding with Trump, a Reuters analysis has shown. Among the emergency actions during the latest term that court observers argue revised existing law, the justices allowed states to redraw the boundaries of U.S. House of Representative districts in the hopes of benefiting Republicans in elections, and weighed in on the rights of parents of transgender children. Using the emergency docket, the court also boosted Trump's power to fire independent federal regulators, allowing him last September to remove Democratic Federal Trade Commission member Rebecca Slaughter. It similarly let Trump fire other agency officials during its previous term. Dissenting in several of those decisions, liberal Justice Elena Kagan said a 1935 precedent of the court that had insulated federal regulators from such at-will firings by a president should have barred Trump's actions. Kagan asserted that the emergency docket should not be used to overrule precedent or revise existing law. On Monday, the court overruled that precedent, a decision that expands presidential powers, in a 6-3 ruling formally affirming the legality of Trump's move to fire Slaughter. It issued its ruling on the Fed's Cook on the same day. The court denied Trump's emergency request that it block decisions by lower courts preventing him from removing Cook based on unproven mortgage fraud allegations that she denies. But the court made clear that its decision did not rule out the possibility of Trump prevailing in his efforts to remove Cook in the future after the allegations are vetted. No other president since the Fed's founding in 1913 ever tried to fire a Fed official. Trump's attempt threatened to undermine the Fed's cherished independence. Justice Samuel Alito, joined by fellow conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch, wrote in dissent that the court should not have issued such a comprehensive ruling on Cook, given that the case was at an early stage and that novel legal issues were involved. Alito noted that the dispute reached the Supreme Court on the emergency docket just 21 days after the litigation began last year. Those problems counseled in favor of a light touch by this court, Alito wrote. Echoing this criticism, conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote in dissent, "While a modest approach would have been appropriate, the court chooses to go big. Its opinion sets precedent on a series of important issues with implications that extend well beyond this case." Roberts responded to the criticism, writing, "How much to say on our interim docket is not reducible to any mechanical formula. It is ultimately a matter of prudence, upon which reasonable minds can and often do disagree." Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote that unlike in other consequential emergency docket cases, the court spent more time considering this one and took the rare step of hearing oral arguments. The complaints by the conservative dissenters mirrored those made by two of the court's liberal justices in another emergency docket decision called Mirabelli v. Bonta in March. In that case, the court blocked a series of California laws that can limit the sharing of information with parents about the gender identity of transgender public school students without the child's permission, siding with Christian parents who challenged these protections. The ruling extended protections under the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment right to due process, recognizing the right of parents to receive this information. These policies likely violate parents' rights to direct the upbringing and education of their children, the ruling stated. In dissent, Kagan, joined by fellow liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, criticized the terse, tonally dismissive ruling designed to conclusively resolve the dispute. Kagan wrote that it will be seen as a judgment on the legal merits, not an interim order, affecting a major development in U.S. law on a politically charged issue. Today's decision shows, not for the first time, how our emergency docket can malfunction, wrote Kagan. The problems with Mirabelli are illustrative of the broader problems of the court's use of its emergency docket to decide significant questions of constitutional law, Yale Law School professor Douglas Najem said. Parties are denied the opportunity to fully brief and argue a case. Lower courts are denied the opportunity to fully consider the merits in the first instance, and the law changes in ways that are not always clear and that leave state actors, lower courts, and ordinary Americans with an insufficient basis on which to move forward, Najem said. The rulings in the Cook and Mirabelli cases reflect the court's ongoing dilemma over how much explanation the justices should attach to emergency orders. Most emergency actions are bare bones, limited to deciding a policy status, enforceable or not, pending a challenge to its legality. Barrett, part of the majority in the Mirabelli case, defended the ruling and the decision to offer legal rationale. interim applications routinely require the court to balance the lock-in risk of saying too much against the transparency cost of saying too little, Barrett wrote in a separate opinion. Roberts, meanwhile, in the Cook ruling, reminded Barrett and the other dissenters, in that case, of her statement in the Mirabelli case. It's not surprising there are internal disagreements on this, as it's a hard issue, George Mason University law professor Ilya Somin said. It can be problematic to both say too much or say too little. Somin said the court cannot easily fix the problem. I would lean towards giving more explanation for decisions rather than less, and only using the shadow docket in cases where there is a very compelling reason, Somin said. Of course, what counts as a compelling reason is likely to divide people with different ideologies and judicial philosophies. U.S. job growth slows in June. Unemployment rate falls to 4.2% amid decline in labor force. By Lucia Muticani. U.S. job growth slowed more than expected in June, and payroll gains for the prior 2 months were revised lower, pointing to a cooling labor market and prompting financial markets to dial back expectations for a near-term interest rate hike from the Federal Reserve. While the Labor Department's closely watched employment report on Thursday showed the unemployment rate dropped to 4.2% last month, that was because about 720,000 people left the labor force, which pushed down the participation rate to the lowest level in more than 5 years. Some economists said the slowdown in job growth was probably a delayed reaction to the Middle East war. Policymakers at the Fed have not articulated their reaction function, but they plainly won't like this employment report, said Christopher Rupke, chief economist at FWD Bonds. It is hard to keep track of which way the pendulum is swinging in the labor market, as the stronger jobs picture just a month ago has suddenly weakened, perhaps with the delayed reaction to the war in the Middle East. Non-farm payrolls increased by 57,000 jobs last month after a downwardly revised 129,000 rise in May, the Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics said. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast payrolls advancing to 110,000 after a previously reported 172,000 increase in May. And that concludes this Thursday's reading from Reuters. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.